Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this Wednesday morning. It's the 27th of September. Hopefully you're having a beautiful day. And if you haven't officially started your day, well, that we can be a part of it and try to make it beautiful in some way, shape, or form by talking about what's happening in our world. Let me introduce our panel to you, and then we'll get started in on the discussion. WAMC's Alan Chartok is with us. Good morning, sir. How are you?
I am present.
Excellent. Always present, and we thank you for that.
Are you a present or are you present?
Gift.
Present
a
enough.
Gift.
Present enough.
Your gift. A present.
I'm also president.
Yeah. Yes, that's true. Very much so. We also welcome. We have two communications consultants with us.
Not good.
And you don't even I don't even think you two consider that you're in competition with one another, right?
No.
All in the same playing field. Joe Bonilla is here. Good morning, Joe.
Good morning.
Good to have you with us as always. And Teresa Bourgeois. Good morning to you as well.
Good morning. Good morning.
A delight to have you here. We welcome your letters. We just want to ask you to keep your letters short. We ask you not to include links. We ask you to send them to the right address. We ask you to not use abbreviations and to proofread your email so we actually know what you're trying to say. And we also ask that you don't yell at us if we don't read your emails on the air because we get a lot of letters and we can't read them all. Right?
And what is the right address?
The right address is panel@wamc.org. panel@wamc.org. Let us begin and talk about what is happening in the world. And I do want to go to the situation in Puerto Rico. It is a dire one, as we know. There are some people who are making the claim now that because there has been such a lag time, the president is coming under great criticism for taking too long in some aspects, and we'll get into those in a moment, of response. And yesterday evening, you started to hear critics, Democrats on the Hill.
And Republicans
say that this was Trump's Katrina, being very critical of the action. As a result, after the 25, 26 tweets about the NFL, he has started to tweet about Puerto Rico and also to announce that he was visiting Puerto Rico. And a lot of the gates have opened as far as the need and people going in, but there still is the question, is it later than it should have been?
Well, you know, Joe, there's a sort of a false equivalency, if that's the right word, because if you listen to the president, he wanted credit for going to Texas and going to Florida and going to those other places as if somehow that was going to deal with the Puerto Rican situation right now.
That's right. And does it, and even by saying that you're going to Puerto Rico is, you know, that doesn't obviously solve the problem or end your commitment as an administration as to what you're going to do for the American people on the island.
Right. And you look at how far away, I mean, he announced he's going next Tuesday versus when he went to Texas and Florida, where it was days after, obviously, the storm had hit. So to really have delayed this so much is really telling in terms of the care of the administration.
Now, just give us a little bit of your background with Puerto Rico, because you have ties.
I have family there. I have family also that got hit in Tampa with Irma as well. So it's devastating. It's worse than you can ever imagine down there. And in terms of an actual recovery effort, it's going to take years. To be honest with you, it's going to take years. The recession hit Puerto Rico particularly hard. So when you look at the infrastructure in Puerto Rico, you look at what the recovery is going to look like. It's not just months as it would be on the mainland. This is a year, multi-year effort that's going to be done, that needs to be done.
Teresa.
Yeah, I'm totally obsessed with the situation. I just, the devastation is unthinkable. And they don't have water that they can drink. The hospitals, I think only six of the hospitals are even operational, and those don't have consistent electricity. They don't have enough power to power dialysis machines or other simple things. I mean, can you imagine being a caretaker of an elder or a young child or anybody who's sick? And I think the problem with Donald Trump is not so much that he's not going till next Tuesday, although that's certainly slow. I think it's that he has a bully pulpit, and he has a finite amount of time. And, you know, he decided over the weekend, instead of using his bully pulpit, his time to draw attention to Puerto Rico, to rally the U.S. around their fellow citizens, he used it to focus on NFL football and attacking football players for not being patriotic. And I think it's not patriotic to not rally around our citizens. Now I think, you know, I have this fantasy that Michael Bloomberg, who's already been down there, you know, he's really focused on a green economy and climate change. And in the absence of leadership from Donald Trump, could people like Michael Bloomberg, and you saw Barack Obama, President Obama came out yesterday, and Bill Clinton, and can they in some way step in where Donald Trump has not been and provide the leadership? And even it'd be interesting if the NFL or the Players Association stepped in and tried to shine some light on this, because they're going to need a lot of support. And it'd be interesting, and I think Judith Ink and Joe knows a lot more about this than me on the substance of it, but if there was a way to help them build back in a way that's green and more resilient.
But right.
Boy, they need help. Finally, the hospital ship that the military has is now finally headed their way, but only yesterday, I believe.
And correct me if I'm actually, let me just read this. I want to read, this is from the Washington Post. President Trump on Tuesday strongly defended his response to the devastation in Puerto Rico, saying his administration was earning tremendous reviews, even as fresh news reports from the hurricane-ravaged island showed an unabated humanitarian crisis. Trump said during a Rose Garden news conference, everybody has said it's amazing the job that we've done in Puerto Rico. We're very proud of it. This was a place that was destroyed. I think we've done a very good job. The president's rosy assessment came amid mounting criticism that he has appeared far less engaged in the recovery efforts of a U.S. territory with a long history of unequal treatment than in those in Texas and Florida after recent hurricanes in those states. Trump did announce plans to visit Puerto Rico next week to get a firsthand look at the aftermath of Hurricane Maria, which killed at least 16 people and left most of the island's 3.4 million people without power and facing serious, serious shortages of food and medical supplies.
Okay, so even in that communication, I was outraged. He didn't focus on the people and on rallying our fellow citizens to help. He focused on saying what a great job he was doing, not rallying support. So we have to, if he's not going to rally support, let's all do it for him. I mean, the PBS.org NewsHour, they have an interesting long list, not long, but a list of about 8 or 10 groups that are on the ground and can use our support. But I think, look at his choice as a communicator, right, Joe?
Right,
I mean,
right.
That, how did he use that moment to praise himself?
Right. And the thing is, even from the beginning of the whole communication regarding Puerto Rico, he called out the island's debt crisis,
exactly.
You know, versus what he did with right. Texas and Florida. So it's like you're already putting the island down, and then you're giving yourself all this credit that's totally undue at this point.
Now, well, he actually used the word bankruptcy, which is something he's quite an expert in.
Right.
And then, oh, you know, the big ocean, it's hard to just drive trucks there, the big ocean. Okay, well, he can get planes to, you know, fly over North Korea, and he can get bombs to Syria. Well, why can't he get help? Now, I will say, I think Governor Cuomo did go right away, did send the National Guard, and so for New York State, they have responded. And you have to feel sorry for the FEMA folks. They were already understaffed, and they must be under a tremendous strain. So, you know, you have a sense that they're probably doing the best they can. But even the federal ask, you know, that's what the Republicans and Democrats in the House yesterday were saying, send us something. By the end of the week, we'll do an emergency fund. And they said, oh, no, it's going to be 2 or 3 weeks before the White House puts together the federal funding request for Puerto Rico.
Right. And you look at the impact we'll have over 2 to 3 weeks, you know, in terms of really the island's recovery efforts. I mean, they can't last 2 to 3 weeks in that regard, in that sense.
They need clean water.
Right.
They need to be able to drink the water. And I was reading some of the healthcare folks were talking about how Lots of people died. That hasn't even been accounted for yet. But now, because of the heat and the water and the that which is in the water, there's going to be a healthcare crisis added on to it because of the mosquitoes, because of the junk in the water. People have been walking through knee-deep, ankle-deep, hip-deep water. There are a couple places where bridges have gone out, so people have to walk through the water. The water is dirty because of all of the
contaminants.
It's hot. I'm just obsessed. I'm sorry. I'll stop.
One of the things, too, that I read or that I heard last night, and I was just trying to find confirmation for it, so I'm a little loose on the facts here, but there are some things that we could have done, and I mean, hindsight is always 20/20, but things of getting more airplanes into the airport, that there's regulation that limits the number of planes that can go into the airport. Those restrictions weren't lifted, so they were sort of tied into this number because it wasn't declared an emergency there, so they could allow that air traffic to come in to, quite frankly, get people out of there. But then that brings up the other issue of, once you get them out of there, where do they go?
Right.
And Teresa, I wanted to ask you about the Jones Act. Could you talk about that for a moment?
Right. I've just learned about the Jones Act, and that has to do with these very old shipping rules that say that, and again, I'm not an expert on it. I was trying to understand it last evening. But lifting the Jones Act. So right now, it has to be U.S. ships because you have to ship within the United States with United States ships. And so that they can, in terms of getting supplies in there, into the ports, it has to be only U.S. ships that go into the ports. And so there's been an outcry in the last 48 hours to lift the Jones Act restrictions to allow other ships, because there's a lot of transport that goes where people fly under different flags, right. You know, other ships. And so it limits who can bring supplies to the island right now. So they're asking for a temporary lifting of the Jones Act restrictions. It's an old, old law that came into being because of the fear of when there was a lot of ship traffic of opponents of the U.S. coming in and destroying ports and such. I did a very poor job of describing the Jones Act, but there we go.
Thank you, Teresa. One of the things that bothered me when Joe read the president's announcement about Puerto Rico was he said everyone knows or everyone says we're doing a great job. Now, that's a big fat lie. And what really bothers me is, who have we heard saying he's doing a great job?
Only him so far. Has the governor of Puerto Rico come? I mean, he said that he's gotten high marks, and I think he's being polite, right?
Yes, because, of course, if you're the governor, if I were advising the governor of Puerto Rico, I would have said to him, no matter what's going on, just keep saying he's doing a great job, because that's what you have to do.
Right,
but
you're at the mercy of the president. Right?
Yes, he has said he's doing a good job, but we need enormous help. But also, think about if I were right now in Florida, or I was still in Houston, Texas, where and the president painted a rosy picture. Everything's great. Everything's doing so well. Well, I heard a story this morning on NPR on the way in about how everything's not doing well. I mean, frankly, I think they're still recovering from Katrina.
Right.
You know, what's happened in Texas, what happened in Florida, these are not days or weeks recovery. These are months and year-long recovery. And so, yes, they did respond well. And I do think we have to applaud the head of FEMA seems to have done a good job. But the challenges are so great. That's why I think if Trump's not going to lead in Puerto Rico, we need to hope that people like Michael Bloomberg and former President Obama and President Clinton, and they have joined forces. They came out yesterday to talk. They really need to step in. And all of us need to, who are concerned about this, need to, you know, figure out how we can help.
Absolutely.
If I were in the solar business, you know, I'd want to rally my solar friends and go down there and see what we could do quickly.
Politically, Alan, how long do these things, you know, we look at the great criticism that President Bush, George W. Bush, got in the response to Katrina. what would it take? This president seems to have some Teflon. I'm interested in when you hear these cries now of people saying it's Trump's Katrina, does it last? Does it hurt him?
Well, there are a couple of things here. Let's not forget that the two places he really paid attention to, Texas and Florida, are basically Republican states right now.
Right.
At least right now they are. And certainly Texas is, and Florida certainly leans that way. So here's Democratic Puerto Rico. It is not without significance that he was slow in the Democratic thing side. He also criticized them, as we have said this morning, for not having a stability in their finances. That's true. But what in the world would that have to do with, as Teresa says, the enormity of this human suffering and tragedy that is going on down there? So this will attach to him. He already has tremendous problems with Hispanic voters in the United States. This is just one more way in which that is going to be aggravated, I think. Joe, do you think so?
Well, I think the other thing, too, is that we don't have the same sort of mainland press and media attention to Puerto Rico as well, as you saw in Texas and Florida. So certainly it's out of sight, out of mind. So when you look at what's happening in Puerto Rico and you look at the photos and the videos, I don't think the American public is seeing the same level of attention and impact as they saw in Texas and Florida. And certainly that will impact the overall response.
And not only that, these polls that are coming out about what people know about Puerto Rico are appalling.
They really
In other words, they don't know that these are American citizens. And so maybe that's part of what Trump's people and their pollsters are counting on here.
We are. We're just about out of time. I also want to, of course, mention we also should include Virgin Islands in this
yes.
as well. Also impacted greatly. We'll talk about all of that and continue our conversation when we come back right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this Wednesday morning, 9:34. Hopefully you are not late for anything. You are right on time to listen to us for the remainder of our time together. Let me introduce, make sure you know who's on the panel. Alan Chartok is here. Joe Bonilla joins us, as well as Teresa Bourgeois. We welcome your letters. Panel@WAMC.org. Panel@WAMC.org. Got a couple of letters. This one from Marty, who says, Teresa, why do you sound surprised that Trump would praise his administration's response to the disaster in Puerto Rico and not express any compassion for the people there? He does not care about people. He only cares about what people can do for him. Puerto Rico offers him nothing politically, so they don't matter to him.
I'm not surprised. I just think the rest of us need to step up. Where he stepped back, I think, you know, there was a lot of talk over the weekend about being patriotic and being an American, and what we do when our fellow citizens are in trouble is we step up and we help them. And if President Trump doesn't want to do that, if he wants to focus on, denigrating athletes, so be it. The rest of us then need to step up and speak out.
Right.
Catherine writes, I wish Trump would stay out of it all, whether the devastation in Puerto Rico or the escalation with North Korea. He just makes everything worse. Mike says, think about it. KKK and neo-Nazis have some fine people. Then he attacks black NFL players for kneeling during the national anthem. His comment on Puerto Rico focused on infrastructure problems and their debt to the big banks. Amazing, Trump's attacks were on people of color. His praise came for white supremacist groups. What does that tell you?
Yeah,
Alan?
It does. I mean, I don't think there's any question that the underlayment of the whole Trump philosophy is a subtle sometimes and blatant sometimes racism. Joe, we heard from Andrea, who said, because of the Jones Act, which forbids foreign vessels to land in Puerto Rico, everything has to go to Miami and then onto Puerto Rico, causing the prices for goods in Puerto Rico to be about 13% more than the average for the U.S. mainland. Puerto Rico is a poor country, and this added cost is one of the reasons why they're in bankruptcy. Continued colonialism.
Yes, I mean, and Jones Act has far-reaching implications for the island, well beyond this storm, and that's what the writer is speaking to. Absolutely, it's the Merchant Marine Act of 1920, law decreed that only American ships could carry goods and passengers from the United States port to another, and every ship must be built, crewed, or owned by American citizens. So that's there you go.
Okay, I want to move on to some other items here, unless anybody has anything else on that.
Just, you know, PBS.org, other places have lists of what you can do, how you can get involved, how you can donate.
All right. Let's talk about the other big story, of course, which is that the health bill has been scrapped. It's official now. Senate Republicans say they will not vote on a health bill. Senate Republicans on Tuesday officially abandoned the latest plan to repeal the Affordable Care Act, shelving a showdown vote on the measure and effectively admitting defeat in their last gasp drive to fulfill a core promise of President Trump and Republican lawmakers. My question about that paragraph from the New York Times is it really the last gasp?
It certainly is not. Look, I can think of 100 scenarios in which things change, and they are all saying that. They're all saying we're not done yet. We're going to do this. We're going to change Obamacare. Well, let's. God forbid that that John McCain dies and that somebody else comes in there. There's another vote. We are seeing a tremendous number of possibilities where things will change and they will rush in and try to do their damage. I don't think anybody who says last gasp has any idea what they're talking about.
I think there's plenty of time still on the clock to get this done. And when you look at, obviously, what the president's looking to do and certainly the Republican Senate, they need to have some real accomplishments going into a midterm year where there's certainly some uncertainty about whether or not they'll be able to keep their majority in the Senate and certainly in the House.
Not only that, Joe, they need the money, desperately need the money. In the beginning, that was the money that was going to fund their tax cuts for the rich, which we know, no matter what they say, we know is what's behind all of this. And so what do we expect? Now they're saying trickle down economics, it'll pay for itself. Have we ever heard that one before?
Yeah. Teresa?
Yeah, I agree with both of you. I think that you only need to look at the press conference that they did after. So the senators, the Republican senators, have a Senate lunch on Tuesday and the Democrats have their lunch. And when they came out of the Senate Republican lunch, did the press conference announcing that they wouldn't vote on it this week. But then they proceeded to talk enthusiastically about how the Republicans now have just the right framework. And we're close to that 50 vote, and now we're just going to keep building on this. So we're taking it off the floor for now, but that's only temporary. And so the framework that they're campaigning on is this notion of a block, do this by block grants back to the states, and they keep comparing it to what they did with welfare reform in the 90s. In so many ways, it's not the same, and that didn't work out so well. But Alan is exactly right about the funding. So today, President Trump is in Indiana to announce the tax plan, or at least they're going to announce the framework of the tax plan. But by all accounts, they haven't a plan yet how to pay for it. This is a consensus of 6 members of the House and Senate Republicans, and they're asking Democrats to join on. And as I said, the caboose is going goodbye, and they're asking the Democrats to get on the caboose. They also note that this was negotiated by Treasury Secretary Mnuchin and the Gary Cohen, the NEC director. But they don't even think or aren't clear that Trump is on board with what they've negotiated because he wants a 15% corporate tax rate, and they say 20. Anyway, it's all about the money, Alan.
Right, it is. And not only that, there is the key question, as you know, Teresa, of whether or not they say, well, this will be the greatest middle class tax cut ever. And when asked about, well, how about the rich? They say, well, we don't know about that yet. Hey, does anybody want to buy a bridge?
Right.
Right. And they've been clear that they're not going to be clear today. They're going to announce the framework, and then they're not going to announce the details, like what deductions will change.
Right.
And they are raising the lowest rate. The lower rate is going to go from 10% up to 12%, and they justify that because they say, well, we're going to double the deduction so it'll all work out.
Right.
Oh, my goodness me. But they'll just keep saying that it's a tax cut for the middle class, and they say it over and over and over.
Yeah.
It's just like the healthcare rhetoric, right, Alan?
Yeah, it's Obamacare, Obamacare, Obamacare. Terrible, terrible, terrible. Pretty soon people are saying Obamacare, that's terrible.
They act like if they say it enough times, it will come true.
Well, it is. You guys are the communications experts, but it's propaganda 101.
But it did work for them on health care to get elected because they kept denigrating the ACA, and they said that they had a good plan, and they were never held to account about the details of the plan. And just like now, all the rhetoric, this is about, you know, helping the middle class. But there's nothing that they've put on the table so far indicates that it actually will help the middle class.
And not only that, you see, they are avoiding assiduously what the deductions are going to be. So we know that the third rail would be taking away people's mortgage deduction, their interest rate on their mortgages, and they are saying, nope, we're not going to do that. And there are a couple of others that are very important to the American people, and they say we're not going to do that. Adding to your perplexity, if there's such a word, of how they're going to pay for it.
And, you know, weaving this back into health care, because I think the tax and the health care issues are completely politically intertwined. The other thing we can't forget is that the Trump administration is just marching forward, destabilizing the Affordable Care Act in this country. You know, they are not being clear with insurance companies about whether or not they'll get payments. They're still month to month. And they are, you know, I said it the other day, it's just dastardly. They have shortened the time frame when people can sign up. And now they're going to shut down the computers, at least on Sunday, the systems for quote-unquote maintenance in the Sundays during the limited time period so that it will be harder. They've cut off the funding for outreach to help people figure out how to sign up. And now they're going to shut down the computer systems for maintenance on Sundays during the enrollment period. Routine maintenance. Yeah, it's all, I mean, Trump said, they were, you know, he's going to
let it implode. Yeah,
let it implode.
Right.
All right. Let's take a break. When we come back, we will continue. We have many other issues to discuss. We welcome your letters. Panel@WAMC.org. Panel@WAMC.org. We'll be right back right after this. Welcome back to the roundtable and our roundtable panel. I want to start off with a letter, which will get us into our next topic. Marlene writes, Silver, now Skelos. Go ahead, elected officials. Clearly, there are no consequences for your illegal behavior. She is speaking, of course, of the federal appeals panel on Tuesday overturning the 2015 corruption convictions of Dean Skelos, once the powerful majority leader of the New York Senate, and his son, Adam, toppling the final bookend of what has been historic back-to-back convictions of two of Albany's most entrenched leaders. Alan, what do you make of Dean Skelos?
Well, you know what's interesting about this is the judges made it quite clear there was substantial evidence about wrongdoing. They just said, in light of what the Supreme Court has said, basically, we don't have any choice. They said the instructions to the jury were not correct, but they said that there was a substantial chance that if they were retried, or Skelos and his son were retried, there would be a conviction. We know from the prosecutors that they are going to retry them. You know, I'm so cynical that I get to think that part of all of this was just to get them out, which succeeded, Silver. And because these guys are oligarchs, they're there forever. They can't lose. And this is the one way that you remove them from office. But I think that the point of the article and your point is exact, and the letter writer's point is exactly right. This is, you know, a rule that you would have had to see in invisible ink, which says, yeah, you know what, we're going to protect our own.
Joe?
Yeah, I mean, again, this is another devastating blow to what, you know, Preet Bharara had done during his term as U.S. attorney. And you look at what the response will be in terms of what the acting U.S. attorney, June Kim, will do. But certainly it speaks to, you know, the volumes of, you know, if you engage in acts of corruption and really use your office for personal gain, you know, pretty much you'll get convicted, but it will get overturned, especially in the post Bob O'Donnell situation.
McDonnell, sorry.
Yep.
That's right. However, you know, I mean, I got to be thinking, maybe this is just unfair. You see a Clarence Thomas up there scratching his head and saying, I wonder, you know, about my own longevity in politics and everything else. Maybe I can project myself into this situation. So, you know, I mean, I think what the court did was on the McDonald case is just awful. And it really is a green light to go ahead and steal.
So how do they keep getting away with this? I mean, how are these? It seems you have one set saying, okay, we're going to convict you, and the next thing, and then turning it over. I'm interested in your point, Alan, of just getting him out of there. But obviously, there still is the wrongdoing at the core of it, right?
Well, I mean, you know, we have laws in this country which are written by the rich and richer. Tremendous numbers of lobbyists and others. You know, I think it's disgraceful. But we all know how it works. It's just not nice.
Teresa, were you going to say something?
No, really. I bow to there. I have more questions than comments. But Alan,
yeah.
If there are future convictions, cases brought, and they're convicted, they would get different instructions, right?
One would think so.
So the problem is that these cases came, you know, after the Supreme Court, prior to the Supreme Court ruling, right?
The cases came. That's an interesting question. I defer to the historians out there who have their fingers on the...
Because I think... Right, because the problem was the instructions that the judge gave turned out to be overruled by the Supreme Court case.
Yes, and, that is correct.
And so but in each case they've said that there is underlying wrongdoing. So does it send a message to others? This is underlying wrongdoing, and now the next time we won't give... You know, we now know the right instructions to give. This is more a question than the experts.
We're not experts, but we're only the same onlookers that everybody else is. But I think that's right. I think what's going to happen now is that Kim and the others have to retry these cases. They have to, because otherwise the green light is just very, very bright for going ahead. If you remember the case of Skelos and the getting the job for the no-show job for the kid, as I remember it, it really was disgraceful, and it is the worst kind of thing that we see in our politics. And you know, I think you're right. I think that there will be different sets of instructions issued now.
But let me ask it this way, just more broadly. Obviously, Preet Bharara and the others were trying to send a signal to elected officials and a message. And was that message received?
Well, I think it. I think at first probably was, because it was more or less a stay tuned. And once, you know, Preet was removed by the president, you know, and now with this most recent news, it really does beg the question: will that culture return back to Albany?
Well, first of all, I would take some issue with you, my esteemed colleague, on this issue as to whether that culture will return to Albany. The one thing about these guys is they never learn. They just don't learn. And so on a regular basis, you see this culture of corruption is there. When I was working with a police commissioner in New York, there came a point at which during the early corruption hearings at Serpico and all the rest of it, there came a point at which you couldn't turn over a rock without finding a corrupt cop at the time. And I think, and I've been hanging around the legislature for long enough to know, that these guys think it's okay because there are a thousand ways they can make it work for them, and they never think they're going to get caught. And that is why I don't believe that the culture of corruption has ever left the place.
But they were playing by what they thought was the set of rules or culture of the way. And so then the question is now, does this say, hey, wait a minute, those aren't the rules. There are new guardrails. There are new way of behavior. And so people have to behave differently. Does it wake them up
they
to
may
that?
Have,
I don't know. I'm not saying it does. I'm saying, does it? Has that happened at all?
Teresa, they've had 1,000 opportunities to change the rules, and they don't do that.
Got it, yeah.
And they don't do it. And they are, there is a culture of corruption. You know, one of the big fights, I have it with my friend Hank DeLay and my oldest friend Jerry Benjamin all the time, is about a constitutional convention. Are we going to put millions and millions of dollars into a constitutional convention and hope that the rules get changed when we know full well that the people who get elected to a constitutional convention are part of the political establishment? You know, I'd love to believe it was going to happen and that there would be more strict anti-corruption rules. I just don't think it's going to happen. I've been around here watching this legislature since the 1960s, and I'm telling you, where there's a will, there's a way. So they may change, as you just suggest, they may change one specific way in which they operate, say, oh, well, we can't do that anymore.
But then there's still all the other stuff that they're doing.
All the creative ways in the world.
Yeah. And if not, it'll come up with new ones.
It'll evolve.
Well, it will. And not only that, these are the whole premise of the legislature, if you really understand it, is you go to a legislator and you say, will you do this for me? And if you do this for me in the future, not quid pro quo, not through a microphone, I'll do something for you. Norman Adler, the great lobbyist, used to talk all the time.
Isn't that how everything works?
Well, yeah, but you've institutionalized it. You've said you're going to prevent corruption, Teresa. And you know, Norman Adler used to say that there was this woman sitting outside a senior state senator's office. Actually, it was John Markey. And he'd go in there every day, and there would be the same lady who was coming to talk to the senator about sitting in a chair, patiently waiting, while people were being, well-heeled people were being channeled in and out of that office. So once you have the basic premise that it's all about money, it's all about quid pro quo, but it's the subtlety of how you do it that it becomes so important.
But there can be behavior that's not criminal. So if a group of people, you know, you say, well, you support my idea, then I'll support you at the polls. Well, that's, you know, that's not corruption. That's building a base.
Right. But
I'm not defending people. I think we have to remember that not everybody who supports a group's ideas is corrupt. You know, that's part of building your constituency, because that's why you're there, to represent a set of ideas,
yeah,
which is separate from corruption.
Right, you are. But there's always that line,
right?
Is when does it go over the line? And in the case of Silver, for example, it was, what was so bad? Just send me your people, and I'll get you a grant.
Well,
send me people for my law practice, and I'll get you a grant.
Right.
And he didn't think there was anything wrong with that.
Well, you see it now. I mean, this might be apples and oranges, but in this college corruption scandal that broke yesterday.
Yep.
You know, that
NCAA.
Yep. College coaches, yeah. And it just, that is just a cesspool of corruption that they disclosed.
And by the way, that's been going on for years.
Right.
We all know it. We all know it. When I taught at Rutgers, I remember, you know, people coming in and saying to me, now, this is a good guy. He's going to be on our basketball team. I was teaching political science. See that he's, you know, he's well received. They never said give him a good grade, but they said, see that he's taken care of.
Read between the lines, right.
All right, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll talk about other cesspools. there's other cesspools. Stuff. Yeah, let's talk about all the cesspools. We'll be back. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. Alan Chartok, Joe Bonilla, and Teresa Bourgeois making up the panel. 5 minutes past 10 o'clock. We welcome your letters. Panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org. Another subject to talk about is the race last night. So we'll start off with this letter from Reed, who says the primary win for Roy Moore should be looked at as an extremely scary harbinger for things to come. White, fraudulently authentic Christian piety being used to openly limit the rights of everyone in the country. Republicans have used this as a tool for decades and cannot control the Bible salesman wing of their party anymore. That letter, of course, having to do with Roy Moore, who won the Senate GOP runoff in Alabama last night, overcoming the efforts by Republicans to rescue his rival, Senator Luther Strange. Moore soundly defeated him on Tuesday. The outcome in the closely watched Senate race dealt a humbling blow to President Trump and other party leaders days after the president pleaded with voters in the state to back Mr. Strange. There are sources, I know CNN is reporting that sources say that Trump is both embarrassed and quote-unquote pissed over the Alabama Senate race. What does he have to be upset about? What does this say, Alan?
Well, first of all, you know, those people who play with fire and get burned by it shouldn't be surprised. There's always somebody to throw a bigger piece of red meat to that base than you have. And I think he's saying maybe I shouldn't have done this endorsement. Well, you know, he did. And now he understands that there is a sense of responsibility that is incumbent on politicians who know what. Who know what's right. Now, Moore, of course, is a guy who is really beyond redemption in so many ways. He's shown racist tendencies, if not outright racism. He's been thrown off the court twice, his own state court twice, and the rest. And he plays to that base in that state. But in the end, I think this is very, very dangerous for the Republican Party. Because it drags them way over to the right. They're all going to be scared of primaries right now. And it is not bad news for the Democrats.
Meanwhile, the Democrat in this race has, in the Alabama race, has a snowball's chance, right?
He has no chance.
All right.
I don't think he's
what did
chance.
I hear, Teresa?
Uh-oh.
It's Alabama, Teresa. What do you know that we don't?
I always have
ever the optimist.
Ever the optimist. Ever well, the optimist. It's just I think he would have had no chance against Luther Strange, it's a very. First of all, he seems very impressive. His name is Doug Jones, and he prosecuted those responsible for killing the four young girls in the 16th Street Baptist Church bombing. And he is a very, very moderate Democrat. He worked for the last Democratic senator to hold that seat was a guy named Howell Heflin, a great old Alabama.
Remember him?
Remember
yep.
him? Wasn't he?
Yeah.
He was there when I was.
He was a character.
Set. Wasn't he? You just had to love him. He was just in his staff, and so Doug Jones was on his Senate Judiciary Committee staff, and so was the last Democrat many, 25 years ago or so to hold that seat. But he's well respected in the state. And he is a conservative Democrat. And he's making the argument that really have to focus on jobs and health care and such. And that Roy Moore is an embarrassment to the state. Go ahead.
Well, the South has gone Republican, let's face it, especially the Deep South. The reason that I think one could make an argument that the Democrat has a chance in this case is that you have a lot of disaffected Republicans who are either going to sit on their hands or are going to vote for the Democrat, say, I'll show you, you bothered with our candidate. You messed up our candidate. So I suppose it's possible. I don't think it's probable.
I don't think it's possible either. But you look at the totality of the race. You had Luther Strange, who was appointed by a now former governor of Alabama, Robert Bentley, who resigned due to an affair. And you look at also that the president may not have his own coattails in the base. The president won 62% against Hillary Clinton last year, And he lost, I mean, basically Moore won by 10 points in this election. So
that's very, a lot, by the way.
Right. So you look at that, I mean, it's not just so much, you know, the turn to basically Trump doesn't have the base, but it might just be very well what Alan said. Basically, this is another hard right turn for the Deep South.
Now, you may remember when David Duke, right? Correct me if I'm wrong. You're our historian here, Teresa. When David Duke ran, the same establishment, everybody came out, Democrats, Republicans. What was he running for, governor in New Orleans or Louisiana? I'm completely...
He ran for governor, and then he ran for state senator, state something.
The Senate.
Yeah.
Senate.
And everybody came out against him, and it worked.
It worked for him.
And it worked. He wasn't elected, and I suspect that's what they thought they were going to do here with this guy.
It was an interesting. I want to read the Alabama papers, and I don't know this guy, but John Archibald. Apparently, he's a big columnist in there, and fascinating column. But he said it was just Alabama being Alabama, picking Roy Moore for the same reason 8 out of 10 Alabama Republicans still approve of the job Donald Trump is doing. This is a part I loved. Trump backers in Alabama just did the thing that they always do when the president speaks. They didn't just listen to his words. They listened for what they wanted them to mean.
Huh.
I thought that was great. But basically, Alan, he was making your point that you know, they voted for Roy Moore because all of the quote-unquote establishment was against him. And but I also think you have to really look carefully at what Steve Bannon did and said, because he came in there for the last 2 days and said this is part of his revolution. And he was there last night at the victory party saying, you know, this is just the first state and we're going to march through all the states and we're going to, you know, basically throw these bums out. And the bums he was talking about were not Democrats. He was talking about Republicans.
Right. But it's also it's fascinating to see a very recently departed White House advisor, you know, going against the president they just served as well. And then basically in a contentious primary such as we just saw.
And it really makes it very hard. I mean, in a way, this is good for the Democrats because it pulls the Republican Party apart. And particularly, you know, you have Senator Bob Corker of Tennessee saying he's leaving. Now, when you get to the point where Bob Corker is a guy you want to stay, you know, you've pulled far to the right.
Right.
But you have the races in Arizona. You have a couple of states where you have the far right going after the right folks. And that just makes it even more difficult for the Republican leader to hold his or her caucus together. Not a good day yesterday for the Republican leadership.
Nope.
All right.
And you had Donald Trump in New York at a high-dollar fundraiser, $250,000 a person fundraiser, an RNC fundraiser, reportedly denigrating, you know, the Republicans in the Senate for not passing health care and such. So,
I think the Corker story is huge.
It is a huge story.
Well, let's talk about it. It is the story having to do with Bob Corker, Republican senator from Tennessee, announcing his retirement. He said Tuesday that he will not seek reelection. Another blow to the Republican establishment on the same day the latest GOP effort to revamp the Affordable Care Act failed. Corker and other Republican leaders in Congress have come under fire from President Trump and his supporters for not delivering in the early days of the administration. Once considered an ally of Trump's national security team, Corker traded insults with the president during the August break amid chatter that staunch conservatives would mount a primary challenge to the Senate Foreign Relations Committee chairman.
For you know, there are certain things that we are used to hearing from people who decide not to run. You know, I want an 85-year-old guy, not Corker, of course, but an 85-year-old guy will say, I want to spend more time with my family.
Right.
You know, with my family. This guy, the chutzpah award goes to Corker because he says, I'm just a citizen legislator. I believe in. So there he is for what, 12 years? Is that right?
Yeah.
12 years and says, you know, I'm a citizen legislator and that's not why I'm running. I'm not going to run. Hey, the reason he's not running is he's scared he's going to be beaten by a right winger. An even more right winger in a primary, and that is something that everybody else is now thinking in that United States Senate. And as the Republicans get pulled over to the right because of these potential primaries and because of these primaries, they lose the middle. And it is the middle which could cost them everything.
Right. And remember that Corker is the one who, in the beginning, he and Trump were getting along. In fact, there was even discussion that he'd be as Secretary of State or come into the administration in some way. But they thought, no, better that he stays the chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. But then the tide turned Trump attacked him. And remember that he did speak up after Charlottesville. And then Trump really attacked him because he spoke up after Charlottesville. But he had come in to the Senate saying that he was just going to run for two terms, that he would leave after two terms. But then he rose so quickly. I mean, it's amazing that after two terms, he's the chairman of the Senate Finance Committee. I mean, that shows you the rapid turnover in the Senate and in the House is a real problem because you don't have any historical memory and experience.
Hey, Joe, I don't want to hijack your agenda setting rights here, but I'm just fascinated by the fact that we're hearing this morning that Special Counsel Mueller has gotten a hold, is getting the IRS information on some of the people involved in this. And I'm very concerned, and I've said this on the show from the beginning, that this has the potential for saying, okay, we're going to get Manafort, we're going to get Flynn, and the president is going to be left out because there's no information as to whether the IRS is giving them Mueller the Trump data also.
Okay, so let's parse that a little bit. So the IRS is now sharing information with Robert Mueller about key Trump campaign officials after two entities clashed this summer over both the scope of the investigation into Russia's meddling in the 2016 election and a raid on former Trump campaign chairman Paul Manafort's home. This is according to CNN. Part of the concern centered on the far-reaching and broad requests from Mueller's team. In the case of Manafort, Mueller's investigators are reaching back 11 years as they investigate possible tax and financial crimes. According to search warrant documents, Mueller is bound by a written order issued by Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein in May, which allows the special counsel to investigate, quote, any matters that arose or may arise directly from the investigation. So your concern, Alan, is that the investigation then becomes about the other guys and not about Trump.
Yes, precisely so. Exactly right. So we're seeing that the leaks that we're hearing about are about Manafort and Flynn. Now, obviously, you can make the argument that what the special prosecutor wants to do, or the special counsel wants to do in this case, is to get them into such hot water that they could tell what they know about Trump and that relationship and the Russians. But on the other hand, it is also possible that they become isolated and they become casualties of war.
Teresa?
Well, it seems that he's trying to pressure them so that they flip, he, Mueller. And also, it seems like there's probably a lot of there. But the other question that I've been pondering is that who's doing the leaks? And is it the White House that's doing the leaks because they want to keep shifting the focus to Manafort and Flynn and think that somehow they can then isolate them as the problem? But it's interesting that this comes up today when the president is out in Indianapolis, announcing a tax plan. And what many people say is, how can he put a tax plan on the table where we still don't know what his taxes are? And so we don't know, the American people don't know if some of these proposals are to enrich him. And that the analysis that's been done on the parts of the plan that people are aware of by the Tax Policy Institute show that he is set to benefit financially, personally, significantly from some of the proposals he's pushing hard. So both for the Mueller investigation and for this, you know, possible comprehensive change in tax policy, his taxes become very important what's in his taxes.
But I think if you look at this perpetual insistence about you know, looking at Manafort and Flynn and all these, you know, figures of the campaign or still within the White House, there is always going to be this insistence upon, you know, directing the attention away from the president and obviously toward these figures. And obviously we're still seeing that right now, and very well could come out of the White House.
And it you had Roger Stone yesterday testifying in the House, which was interesting again. And then you have Trump this morning tweeting fake news, fake news, fake news. He's on a tweet storm attack on the media again. It'll be interesting to see how he reacts at today's announcement, if he'll stay on script or not.
I have a couple letters here that we'll finish up with. This one from Kathleen, who says, I agree that the GOP repeats and repeats the same false message until it becomes widely accepted. Where are the Democrats slash progressives? Why are they not yelling the messages over and over from all the rooftops?
Well, you know, it's interesting because when there was the so-called debate on CNN the other night between Bernie Sanders and the Republicans, and the Republicans got all the play, and you didn't even know Sanders was there. You know, I'm fascinated by that whole thing. The Democrats say a lot, but I don't know that we hear a lot about it.
Yeah, I mean, I think that they are talking, they have messages, they're, you know, clearly what they stand for on health care, on jobs, on education, but it's not breaking through because...
they're not in power.
Right, they're not in power. And then Trump so dominates. I mean, think about what happened over the weekend. It's really stunning. People are dying in Puerto Rico. I'm going to circle back to Puerto Rico, but you know, this tragedy in Puerto Rico that you'd think would be the focus of attention, but Trump's capacity to control the message was so great that by, you know, he knew what he was doing by, you know, this culture war. While everyone says it's horrible, they still look at it. They still follow it. The media still covers it. It dominates. I mean, listen to as Hillary Clinton talks about her campaign, you know, one of the big problems that they had. Her campaign said over and over, Russia is interfering with the election. But they were never able to break through on that and get people to focus or on all of the other messages because of Trump's big, shiny, crazy objects.
Well, I think if you look at the two campaigns, you look at the two different viewpoints, you had one that was more focused on the 24-hour news cycle versus the 140-character news cycle. And I think that makes a certain difference in terms of how you're able to distill points. And I think the president, to his credit, unfortunately, has gotten to a good level of really getting down these messages to a point where, you know, the great public can understand.
But it's also which, Alan, and maybe you can speak to this, what you're willing to say. I mean, if you're willing to denigrate Gold Star families, if you're willing to denigrate POWs, if you're willing to denigrate people with disabilities, you know, that's what broke through in denigrating African-American football players.
Just about half a minute. Alan, you want to say anything?
No, I think that Teresa's been brilliant on this. I think she's exactly right.
All right, we're going to hold it there for this morning and remind you that we'll be back again tomorrow. Teresa, you'll be here.
I'll come back.
Alan will be here. Joe, we'll probably see you next week.
Yep, that works.
We look forward to that. Excellent. And we will continue our conversation panel at WAMC.org, and we will continue the program right after this.